touch of home. Searle, Grandma said to my grandpa, my catalogs are missing again. Her permed hair bobbed as she lifted the Chesterfield cushions. One of the boys keeps taking them and hiding them all over the house, and they need to order something. She stood, mouth open. Maybe they have to order something too, Jackie. Grandpa smirked at me and returned to his egg and bacon breakfast. The fork and knife looked tiny in his elevator mechanic hands. I peered at my feet, which dangled from the chair next to him. His thumbs were about twice the size of my big toes. My eyes barely rose above the kitchen table. Grandma left to go down to the laundry room. Her slippers slapped against the hard yellow calluses on her heels, like leather against wood. What's the verdict, Jesse? Do you have something to order? Before I could answer, Grandpa delivered a swift karate chop to my leg. Hiya! My knee jerked. I squealed with glee as eggs spilled out of my mouth and down the front of my PJs. Grandpa! I shouted, half shocked, half laughing, ketchup smeared all over my lips and chin. He just winked, looking like Popeye without his corn cob pipe. His forearms were bigger than Popeye's for sure. Watch it, buddy, he said as he put up his dukes. I put mine up like a little fighting Irishman. Grandma called upstairs. Searle, wait till you see this. I heard her heavy rhino steps, then saw her. She had the missing catalog in her hand. I found it behind the toy box. Look! She opened it and held it up. Just like the last few times it went missing, she placed it in front of my grandfather and pointed. The woman's underwear section is ripped out, the whole section. Well, I didn't do it. Must have been one of the boys, he said, and laughed. At least they took the best part. Searle, Grandma looked disgusted. I pushed my eggs around to avoid eye contact, but she leaned forward, crossing her arms over the damaged magazine. Jesse, do you know who did this? Her brown-rimmed glasses magnified her eyes. Grandpa turned to face me. No, Grandma. Yorkie, the wonder dog, who'd become my most trusted friend and ally, came in and pooped near the fridge, saving me from saying more. Grandpa pushed aside his breakfast, and Grandma ran over as Yorkie scurried away with a guilty dog smile, his tail tucked between his legs. You see what happens when you boys don't walk 'em enough? Grandma grabbed a grocery bag from under the kitchen sink and dangled it in my direction. Come and clean it up. I usually woke up early, and often was the first one up. It was something I'd learned while living with Dad. The first one up into the cupboards or the fridge was the first one to eat, and the first one to eat was often the only one to eat. But this morning at my grandparents', I stayed in bed, cozy in my own room, buried under my blanket, not worried about breakfast. My grandparents had lots of treats, and my instinct to be the first one up was giving way to a desire to sleep in. I awoke to find Grandma in my room. Jesse, time to get up. She put an armful of clothes on the chest of drawers and began folding sweaters. Aunt Sherry and Uncle John are coming over, and we've got to get you ready. Aunt Sherry was my grandparents' only daughter, and Grandpa's favorite child by a long shot. She was the youngest and pretty, with long, flowing brown hair and beautiful hazel eyes. She always made us the best food when she came over. Fried chicken, pasta with salty cheese, and chocolate cake. Uncle John, her husband, was strong like a lumberjack. He cut wood with an axe, beard and all, at their house in the country. And I imagined he was so powerful because of all the delicious foods Aunt Sherry made him. I cleared the sleep from my eyes and sat up. Yorkie ran in, his tail wagging and tongue hanging out. He jumped on the bed to lick my face, and the sound of crunching echoed throughout the room. Crunch, 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 crunch. Everywhere he put his paws on the bed, the sound resonated. What the hell? Grandma said and turned to investigate the strange noise. Stop moving, dog, I pleaded silently. Yorkie continued to romp about. Grandma grabbed him by the scruff, threw him off the bed, then reached down and pulled my covers back. I tried raking them back up, but she'd already seen. Strewn all around me were pages and pages of the Sears catalogs. There must have been about 75 beautiful young underwear models nestled in my bed. "It was you," Grandma said. "Why?" I tried to hide. I don't know. They... Grandma pushed the ripped pages aside and sat beside me. "I like them," I whispered. Yorkie put his paws on the bed again. "They remind me of my mom. They're beautiful." Grandma's scents, curves, and soft voice had taken the place of my mother's, but they weren't the same. Mom's body was brown and lean. Grandma's was beige and chubby, with wrinkles and moles all over. I missed holding onto my mother's leg, nuzzling her breast, cuddling against her stomach. I missed feeling the strength her being possessed, the sense of warmth and protection. No matter how hard I squeezed, Grandma just wasn't home. "Oh, baby," Grandma said and hugged me. Godzilla. When I walked into class the first day of kindergarten, I saw a kid standing alone by the Tinker Toys and colored blocks in the corner near Mrs. S.'s desk. He was much shorter than me. His hair was dark brown, cut into a strange kind of bowl cut, and his nose was large and hatchet-shaped. "My name is Leroy," the kid said. "I'm a Newfie. My parents come from an island called Newfoundland." I knew where that was because Grandpa came from Cape Breton. I imagined a land of Newfies with big noses, just like my new friend. I soon found out that he lived on my street, right around the corner from my house. In all, it was around 50 meters from his door to mine. Leroy and I got along right from the beginning. We'd jump our bikes off curbs after school, and he was the only kid on our block who could beat me in a race. But I was tougher and could get the best of him most times. Having older brothers gave me an advantage. He took me to cool spots like the gravel pit, where we'd catch frogs and crayfish. Jerry would come with us too, but it was clear that Leroy and I were best friends. Leroy had a big sister named Sylvia, who was in grade 2 with my brother Josh. She was twice the size of me and Leroy. "We need to watch out for her," Leroy said. "She's a bully." There was a wall that separated the kindergarten section from the older kids' playground out back. Whenever Sylvia came into our area, we'd whistle to warn each other and then take cover behind the bushes. Most times, we escaped her wrath, but sometimes she'd catch us by surprise and beat the pulp out of us. Her strength was unreal, like some real-life version of Godzilla, but with dirty blonde hair and a frilly pink dress. Her footsteps seemed to shake the very earth beneath our feet, and her nose was even larger than Leroy's. When she'd throttle me, I thought it resembled the snout of a T-Rex, roaring and full of dinosaur teeth. One day, Leroy and I had had enough. We decided we were going to fire a giant wad of gum into Sylvia's hair at recess. She'd beaten and embarrassed us too many times. The moment the wet gum left the sling and slapped the side of her head, we knew we'd taken it too far. She reached back and tried pulling it out, but that only made things worse. The gum stuck to her fingers and formed thin strands that blew back with the wind. A whole spider web of gum clung to the side of her face and neck. Her hair would have to be cut to get the gum out. Tears filled her eyes and she let out the most monstrous screech I'd ever heard. Her very body seemed to grow larger and larger the louder she yelled. Then she moved with lightning speed, cornered us, and began pummeling us in front of everyone. Our classmates began screeching, save them, Mrs. S. Sylvia is going to murder them, as she tossed us in the air like rag dolls. It felt like I flew 5 feet in one direction, Leroy 4 in the other. We knew we'd probably die if we stuck around, so we decided to make a run for it. The playground was boxed in on one side by the school and surrounded by fences on the others, and Sylvia blocked the way back to the main road, so the gravel pit on the other side of the playground seemed like our only option. I signaled to Leroy with my eyes, he did the same back, and the instant our sneakers hit the ground, we bolted. Sylvia may have been bigger and stronger than us, but we were faster, and we ran like our lives depended on it. When we thought we had a good lead, we turned to see how much earth separated us from the gum-haired Godzilla. She was about a half kilometer away, screaming, crying, and cursing. For now, we were safe from the beast's clutches. For now, victory was ours. From then on, Leroy and I were inseparable. Leroy and the Brown Pop. Leroy's parents both worked days, and he stayed in the afternoon school program until his mom or dad picked him up at 4:30 p.m. Sylvia also stayed after school, and Leroy didn't like being in an enclosed space for 2 hours with his big sister and the other kids. "The class breaks out into wrestling matches," he said, "and I always get the worst of it from Sylvia. Come play at my house," I said to him one day. Once 4:20 hit, he could walk back to school for his 4:30 pickup, like he'd never left at all. He jumped at the chance at freedom. None of the kids usually liked coming to our house to play. Who could blame them? It was like stepping into a time machine. We had blocks of wood to play with, bits of steel my grandpa brought home from his construction job, some old dinky cars, a couple of beat-up hockey sticks from my uncle's, and a few beach rocks we'd picked up in Cape Breton on our yearly trips. I knew my grandparents loved us. They just didn't have lots of money. We did get some good toys at Christmas, though, from our uncles and aunts, but we always destroyed them in a few days. Josh dismantled them to look inside and see how they were made and never put them back together, and Jerry and I simply abused them. Down in our basement, I chucked a half-painted red block of wood across the concrete floor at Leroy, trying to pretend it was Superman. It bounced and stopped dead in its tracks. Definitely not Superman. Leroy let out a sigh. 30 minutes after reaching my house, I knew he was bored out of his mind. I began searching around for a way to keep us occupied. Then it hit me. I did have something Leroy didn't have. Something way better than even his mountainous hoard of awesome toys. "Leroy," I said, so excited I just about shit myself. "Want to try something?" "Sure," he said, unenthused. I walked over to the fridge and yanked on the handle. The seal on the door broke and revealed a massive stack of Labatt 50 beers, piled sideways, one on top of the other. They formed an odd pyramid shape that almost touched the bottom of the freezer. There must have been over 3 feet of them, 90 at least. The brown bodies of the bottles seemed to sweat and gleam in the neon basement light. "Brown Pop," I said to Leroy. My dad used to give me sips of it when I lived with him in Sudbury, especially when I was crying. I remembered it tasted horrible, but I drank it anyways, and the more I drank without complaining, the louder my dad and his friends laughed. They laughed loudest when Dad put me on the counter and I'd piss in the kitchen sink like they did. Grandpa, too, loved Brown Pop, and it was my job to bring them to him when he came home from work every night. "Baby boy," he'd holler from his purple armchair in the living room, "give me a cold one." I'd drop whatever I was doing, go grab one from the fridge, and run it upstairs. An empty bottle was always waiting for return by the side of the coffee table. If I was fast enough, and he was in a good mood, he'd give me a karate chop to the leg, then rub my hair. "That's my boy," he'd say through clenched teeth. "I'm not sure if you've ever tried them," I said to Leroy, "but my grandpa loves them. My dad does too. They say it puts hair on your chest." "Hair?" "Yeah." I stepped back so Leroy could look inside the fridge. "My dad drinks these too. So does my mom, but not this kind." I grabbed one and shut the door. The cold glass felt nice. "This metal thing on the wall, that's the opener." Leroy examined it. "You just put the cap in on an angle under the top tooth," I showed him. "Then you press the bottom of the bottle. The lid will come right off. I do it all the time for Grandpa." I could tell by the way he'd been looking at the opener that he'd never open a bottle himself. When I pressed the bottle towards the wall, it hissed, and the cap fell and danced on the ground by our feet. Before I lost my courage, I hoisted the bottle to my lips and took a big swig. I could tell Leroy wanted to try it too. I gulped with all my might and almost vomited. A second later, my stomach convulsed, but I said, "Ah," and wiped my mouth with the back of my hand. "Give it to me," Leroy demanded. He snatched the bottle. It was clear he wanted to impress me. The swill he took was bigger than mine, and his eyes bulged. He spat it out all over the back of the bar. "That's disgusting." I rescued the bottle from him before he dropped it. The brown pop still felt warm and bubbly inside my guts. "No, I want to do it," he yelled and yanked the bottle out of my hand. His chug was even bigger than before. This time he kept it down. Success. He smiled and let out a huge burp, and we both giggled. By the end of the third bottle, I had a pressing urge to pee. I attempted to walk to the washroom but couldn't see right, and my legs gave out halfway to the stairs. I fell in the middle of the floor and pissed myself where I lay. Leroy, too, tried taking a few steps, but his legs buckled, and he veered off and slammed headfirst into the bar. He looked like a disoriented cat that tumbles sideways after being spun round and round. As he toppled to the ground, the bottle fell and smashed on the floor. We howled with laughter, our legs and arms writhing. My grandmother must have heard all the commotion, because before I knew it, she was standing over the two of us, hands on her hips. "What in God's name are the two of you up to now?" Her nose sniffed at the air. We continued giggling, unable to collect ourselves, and totally unafraid. She grabbed my shoulders and hoisted me to my feet. "Dear Lord, are you drunk, Jesse?" She let go of me. I tumbled toward her, grabbing her shirt for balance. She had her answer. "I'm fergaz." I tried explaining what we'd done, but nothing but baffle gab came out. Leroy was cackling beside us, rolling dangerously close to the broken bottle. Grandma stood him up before he cut himself. She tried to scold us, but started laughing until she wheezed, tears rolling out of her eyes. I'd never seen her laugh so deeply over something I'd done. It made me feel good. She got us upstairs and gave us a few drinks of water and some bread, and changed my pants. "Now get outside and walk it off," she said, shooing us away. "Like two miniature drunken sailors you are." We eventually fell asleep under a neighbor's tree, a few houses down the street. When I woke up, Leroy was gone. Robin's Eggs. My friend Brian, who lived down the street, told me he had a secret one day, and that if I kept my mouth shut, he'd show me. I promised not to tell a soul, and Brian showed me a robin's nest in his backyard. Every day, Brian and his family put seeds down beside the nest to feed the mother robin before she went foraging in the afternoon. She would leave at the same time every day, 4:30 p.m. on the dot. I remember looking at the eggs in wonder. There were three of them, and they were so beautiful, bright baby blue, tucked into the yellowed grass and mud of the nest. I imagine the eggs carefully positioned by their mother's feet, protected under her soft feathers and guarded by her watchful eye. Brian's mother called him in for dinner. "I'll wait for you and watch over the eggs while you eat," I said. Assured, he left. As soon as he did, I grabbed the eggs, put them in my sock, and ran home. On the way, I slipped and fell and broke the eggs. Shocked at what I'd done, I threw the sock in the sewer, then hid in my grandparents' basement. About a half hour later, Brian and his parents, Mr. and Mrs. T, showed up at our door looking for me. Mr. T was a police officer, but was kind to me and my brothers, and sometimes even played catch with us neighborhood kids. Mrs. T was even nicer, always baking up batches of cookies for Brian and me when we played Montezuma's Revenge on his computer, the only high-powered computer on our street. My grandmother searched the house and found me behind a stack of boxes. "I'm really sorry," I said when I was confronted about the eggs, and told them what I'd done. Brian cried. He was heartbroken. "Why did you steal the eggs?" Brian's mother asked. I broke down into a blubbering mess. The more they asked, the more I bawled. But I didn't tell them why I did it. My grandparents gave me the licking of my life, but I didn't break. I still didn't tell them why I stole the eggs. When I saw Brian the next day at school, he wouldn't talk to me. The truth is, when I saw the eggs tucked into the nest, it reminded me of my brothers and me and our home in Saskatchewan. I thought of how much that Mother Robin loved those eggs, and how well she and Brian's family took care of them, and I got jealous. The eggs had their mother, and me and my brothers didn't anymore. So I took the eggs. I thought that if I had them, in some way, I'd have the same love the eggs had. And that would mean, in some way, I'd have a mother's love again. Attaboy. As soon as I could hold a screwdriver and control a jigsaw, when I was about 6 years old, Grandpa trained me to use tools. Grandpa believed in an honest day's work. He told us he was raised by his grandfather, Pappy Peter MacKinnon, after his own father, a coal miner, passed from a heart attack. He used to say that if a man didn't have calloused hands, he couldn't be trusted and didn't really work. He also said your word was your worth, something that meant life or death when he grew up during the Depression. Because of his beliefs, I never heard Grandpa lie, never, not even if it hurt him to tell the truth. If a man knows how to build, Grandpa said, as he wrapped my small hands around the circular saw, he owns the world. Anything is possible. It's like large-scale Legos, just with sweat and more thinking. Grandpa steadied the 5x8 plywood board on the sawhorses, positioned my hips and arms, and continued with his lesson. I built my own house once, in Ottawa, just to see if I could do it. Nice house, too. And I had to work one of these saws all the time. After I teach you, you'll know how to do it for life. Josh cried at first when Grandpa tried to teach him to work the saw, and almost gave up before he gritted his teeth, focused, then ran the blade straight through, winning Grandpa's admiration. Jerry flat out refused. I assumed it was because whenever Grandpa taught us any new skill, it meant we'd have to use it to help him on one of his projects. Studding up the basement, ripping plywood for the skirting around the cabin down east, or building a new deck in the backyard. All were new things we'd done once he'd trained us on new tools. When Josh asked him why he made us work so hard, he said that it was because his father had died when he was 5 years old. "That's when I became a man," he'd say. "I didn't have no childhood working in the mines. But growing up without my father made me tough, like a dried piece of salt cod left out in the sun too long." Grandpappy Peter also taught me to work up on Black Point, fishing in the dory, and I ain't letting you boys grow up without some of that hardness. Working was the only thing that pulled me and my mother out of the Depression. Jerry always rolled his eyes when Grandpa went into one of his hard-done-by speeches. As I steadied the saw, which was about the size of my torso, I imagined how hard working the way he did must have been for my grandfather. "Just hold it straight, level, follow the line, and let the blade do the work. Most importantly, don't be afraid. I'll catch the offcut so the saw doesn't kick when it falls. And if it does, Buck, for God's sakes, don't try to grab it. Just let it go," Grandpa said. "Got it?" "Okay, Grandpa." I placed the face of the saw on the board up against the clamp straight edge, my arms straining to keep it level. Both my brothers were looking on, and I tried my best to hide my fear from everyone. Jerry smirked and made a face. Josh joined in. "Exactly. Now press the trigger and let her rip, just like Josh." Grandpa got into position behind me and made sure the extension cord wasn't in the way. 1, 2, 3, I counted in my head, then squeezed the trigger tight. I had to fight the urge to close my eyes or run away. The whine of the power saw frightened me at first, but I waited a second until I was comfortable pushing the machine forward. Grandpa nudged the back of my elbow, and the blade moaned and bit into the wood. "Now easy does it, Jess. Steady." The smell of pine filled my nostrils as sawdust kicked down onto my foot and back towards Jerry. I kept my eye on the plywood where the saw met the straight edge. Surprisingly, the saw tugged my hands and lurched forward on its own, but I pulled back against its torque, created some resistance, and kept everything balanced. Soon the blade had run through the length of the wood, and the board offcut fell into my grandfather's hands. It looked like a baby delivered into the waiting arms of a doctor. He laughed out loud and his belly shook up and down behind his brown, oil-stained overalls. "That's how it's done. That's my baby boy." His eyes beamed with pride as he turned to face Josh and Jerry, who stood cross-armed. Both grimaced at me. I knew I'd get it from both of them later when Grandpa wasn't around. Despite the impending beating, I was proud of myself, even though it was only one piece of lumber. "Thanks, Papa," I said, grinning from ear to ear. I wasn't scared at all. "I know. Attaboy, Jess, attaboy." He reached over to the radio and turned up the George Jones song that crackled across the AM sound waves. He hummed to himself as he examined my cut, then lit a cigarette. "Listen, boys," he said, a plume of Du Maurier smoke swirling around his stubbled face. "I got a secret weapon. No one will have a go-kart racer like ours. Trust me, we'll never lose." He promised us we'd build a go-kart once we'd learned how to use the saw. He shuffled out onto the driveway, over to the side of his van, then slapped the side panel. "A man must drive in style, boys, with a clean vehicle. That's his horse. You ever see knights riding around on scrawny beat-up horses destined for the glue factory? Well, there's a reason for that." Josh turned to me and said, "What the hell is he talking about? Glue factories didn't exist back when knights were around." Jerry laughed and said, "He's trying to say that after we're finished with the go-kart, we have to wash the van again." While he pretended he was riding a horse, swinging a cowboy hat above his head, galloping around Josh and me. Grandpa emerged from the van and caught Jerry making fun of him. "You look like a chubby version of Roy Rogers galloping around all cockeyed without a horse or gun." Josh and I howled, while Jerry stood there stunned. Grandpa never talked much while he worked, and today was no different, while the four of us toiled away on the go-kart. We just kind of nodded and passed each other's tools like nurses give surgeons instruments in the operating room. Noiseless and quick, no mistakes. I think that's when we were closest, when we were silently working away in the garage, fixing the van, or doing other things. When the job was done, Grandpa cracked a beer and we all drank Coke. "It's a fine racer," Grandpa said. The go-kart was all decked out with a real car seat, 2-inch thick chassis, and rope steering, and it rode on the fastest, most durable wheels known to man, as he put it. Grandpa had pulled a set of 4 elevator wheels from the van. They were yellow and small and the same color and texture as glycerin soap. I just about pissed myself thinking of beating the pants off the other kids around us in the go-karts they had made with their fathers. Jerry got the first push down the block. I figured it was because Grandpa felt bad about his comment earlier. Jerry screamed down the street, smiling and laughing, hair waving in the air. We cheered him on from the driveway and Grandpa took a swig and hollered, "Attaboy, Jerry, attaboy." We all lived to hear him say those words. Little Thief. "Jesse," Grandma called from upstairs. I could hear from the crinkle of paper and foil that she was searching through an empty pack of cigarettes on the phone stand beside her rocking chair. The terse clinks of her lighter against the side of the ashtray told me she was getting impatient. "Jesse, hurry up. I need smokes." She broke into a fit of coughing. Grandma, without her smokes, was scary. She got aggravated, which usually meant we got more chores. The longer she went without nicotine, the more toilets we had to wash, the more carpets we had to vacuum, and the more frequently we had to walk the dog. I ran upstairs. "Here's the letter. John is working today. You know the kind. Du Maurier Special Mild. The tall silver box, not the short red one. Here's the money, and don't lollygag." Going to the store was fun. I wasn't allowed to go there usually, only when Grandma sent me. It was far outside my safe terrain, 2 blocks farther, past the parquet, across the schoolyard, and down the street where I didn't know anybody. Grandpa would warn me about the older boys who hung around outside the store saying they were selling drugs and that their minds were warped by heavy metal music. He said they were just like my dad. I wondered about my father, where he was, why he wasn't around, and if he was still mad at me. "Was it my fault he took off?" I questioned as I skipped down the street. "Does he miss me like I miss him?" I rounded the corner and saw the older boys hanging out around the store payphone, their music blaring on their silver ghetto blaster. I imagined my dad with the same kind of rocker haircut, cut-off jean jacket, and a black Ozzy Osbourne concert shirt. "Hey, little man," Mitch, the oldest boy, said. "Come here a second. I want to ask you something." The other 3 boys were passing around a cigarette that smelled like a skunk, and they coughed like my grandma did when she woke up. I wondered how Mitch and his friends could squeeze through the hidden hole in the fence behind where they were standing. I'd seen them do it whenever the police pulled up to the store. My dad had run like that. I got closer, my hand clutching the $10 bill Grandma had given me. Mitch's aviator glasses glinted and blinded me for a second. "It's cool, little man. We ain't gonna hurt you. Relax." Mitch smiled at me. "You here to buy cigarettes for your granny?" Yes. I stammered, my gut churning. I searched to see if Grandpa was anywhere. He'd beat me if he caught me with Mitch and his friends. Mitch leaned over. "Can you do us a favor?" The other boy suddenly turned and loomed over me. "Can you buy us a pack of cigarettes? John won't sell to us because our parents told him not to. But he'll sell to you because he knows your grandma." My legs went wobbly. I'm not supposed to talk to you or anything. I'm just here to get her cigarettes. I'll get into trouble. No one will know. Mitch thrust a $10 bill into my hand. "Players, king size, 20s. Now go. I'll be here." Mitch pushed me towards the store and watched as I pulled on the glass door. I hauled away on it until my arm almost came out of its socket. It was so heavy. Each of the boys cracked a sideways smile. I didn't have a choice. They beat guys up if they didn't listen, and I was small. I smiled back and made it in. John was at the counter. "What is it today, Chief?" he said, his tanned face beaming in the dust-filled light. John's hair was curly and cut short. I once heard Grandpa say he was a half-breed like me and my brothers, but our hair and skin didn't look like his. He looked half black and half white to me. "Here, the silver ones for my grandma." I slapped down Grandma's letter. John turned around to select a pack from the shelf behind him, and my hand shot toward the shelf of candy bars. I grabbed as many as I could and stuffed them into my underwear, just like Josh and Jerry had taught me. I must have snatched about 10. John turned back, his head cocked, and asked, "Is that it, Chief?" I almost shit my pants. "No, sir. I'd like to buy another pack of cigarettes. Players, King, 20. I reached into my pocket for Mitch's 10. The ruffling noise of candy bar wrappers sounded louder to me than someone crunching up hundreds of newspaper pages. I kept my eyes on his to see if he'd notice. "Players?" he asked. "Your grandparents don't smoke those." My uncle!" I burst out. "They're for my uncle." He looked me up and down, then swiveled back to the shelf. I saw my opportunity and my hands darted forward, grasping about 5 packs of Fun Dip and 6 packs of Big League Chew and rammed them in my pants. I felt a chocolate bar fall to my ankle. Somehow my pants kept it in there. I'll give them to you today, John said as he slid the players and change across the counter. But next time, I'll need a letter from your uncle, too. I grinned even though it felt weird, and said I'd bring the letter next time, then waddled towards the door. It sounded like I was wearing a diaper. Hey, wait, John called out. Sweat was pouring from my forehead like water from a faucet. Tell your grandpa I say hi. The lottery is up today. He needs to play to win. Okay, I nodded and left. Before the door closed, the chocolate bar down by my ankle dropped onto the floor. I booted it onto the sidewalk and waited for the door to close behind me. I thought for sure John had seen it. But I walked over to the payphone to give Mitch the cigarettes, and John just stood there behind the counter and watched as the older boys ran up to me. One of them, the one who appeared slowest and sleepiest of them all, scooped the candy bar off the pavement. Mitch's gang told me I could keep the change for the work I'd done, about $4.50. I told them John needed a letter next time. No problem, Mitch said, as he lit a smoke. This will be our little thing, okay? I agreed. Buying cigarettes for the older boys for pocket change sounded great. They were so busy swarming for cigarettes, they didn't even notice my gotchies were filled with about a half case of chocolate bars and gum. When I got home, Grandma wasn't in a rocking chair in front of the veranda door like usual. Something was up. Yorkie barked, and I heard Grandma stampede down 3 flights of stairs faster than I'd ever heard her move before. She charged at me. I turned to escape, but she shoved the door closed. John called, she roared like a pissed-off bear, her lips gnarled back so I could see her black cigarette-stained teeth. His candy bar shelves are bare. He also told me you bought a pack of players? She pulled my pants down before I knew what was happening, and my hoard fell onto the floor. I started crying. She was having none of it and started spanking me. Why? She screamed. Why are you stealing? She started to weep, and it hit me even harder. I didn't steal, Grandma. Some kids gave these to me, and I stuck them in my pants. She looked confused. And now you lie to me on top of it? My God, Jesse, what is wrong with you? She smacked me across the mouth, then pushed me into the corner while she gathered the chocolate bars and gum. I tried to pull them out of her hands, but she was stronger than me. She slapped me again. My cheek was on fire. I'm not lying, Grandma. The bad kids outside the store got me to buy them a pack of cigarettes and gave me this candy. That's what they paid me with. I knew it was something that she would understand. The bad, drug-dealing kids, just like her son. Grandpa always cursed them, and I hoped my lie would sound believable to her. They said they'd beat me up if I didn't. To my surprise, Grandma stopped. I stared at her. I knew she was weighing the possibility of truth in my gigantic lie. I'm sorry, Jesse. The lie had worked. She thought I'd been bullied. Guilt washed over me. I'd used my dad against her. But I didn't tell her the truth. Well, your grandfather will hear about this. But when Grandpa returned home from work that night, nothing was said. My grandmother, I figure, didn't want to get in trouble either. I thought about the feeling of excitement I'd had grabbing the chocolate bars off the shelf when John had turned his back. The feeling of power. Now I had a strange and satisfying feeling of control. Control I'd never had before. I liked it. Supremacy. My brothers and I fought almost every day at school. This was my second time in grade 2, and fighting probably had something to do with it. If anyone too big or too strong, say from grade 4 or 5, picked on me, I'd band together with Leroy, and we'd annihilate them. We'd chuck rocks, throw baseball bats or whatever, trip people when they weren't looking, or pummel them right in the hallways, whatever it took. Many times we ended up in detention or in the principal's office together. But Leroy and I weren't bullies. We didn't go looking for it. We only reacted when we were picked on. And if Leroy and I couldn't handle it, I'd run to my brothers, by far the strongest kids their age, who could. We Thistle Blois, plus Leroy, formed a kind of warrior clan that dominated a section of the schoolyard near the portables and benches. We covered about 20 square meters of terrain, but our domination over this area was contested. There were other tribes of boys, older and younger than us, vying for supremacy, always trying to take our spot. These clans were formed by friends, brothers, cousins, and, if things got intense enough, competing enemies would forge alliances to vanquish common foes. Otis, Herschel, and the other five black kids in the school formed the strongest clan, but they were more interested in breakdancing and girls, and were too old to bother with the second and third graders. Next, there were the two Smith boys and their sister, Tanya, along with the rest of the Simmons Street kids. They all played rep hockey, which meant they fought well as a coordinated team. They were quick with their fist and reminded me of professional NHL enforcers. The Histon crew, on the other hand, was a handful of kids who weren't into sports at all and liked to read the Hardy Boys. James and Doug, two English-descended kids who lived near the fence, were friends with me and Josh. Sometimes when we needed to duck out from a beatdown, they'd invite us over for KD until things cooled off. The most dangerous kids, however, were the loners. Amongst them was a Vietnamese girl named May, who was the most brutal fighter at our school, even though she was tiny. Once I pissed her off and she just about scratched my eyes out. Even the older kids wouldn't mess with May. She'd sent scores of tough guys home crying to their mothers. But May was sweet if you didn't provoke her, and she never bothered me about my missing parents or called me Indian. Our arch enemies at school, though, were Ronald and Kurt and their sidekick, Ethan. They didn't need provoking. They'd go out of their way to kick my shins, steal my lunch, push me face down in the mud on the way home from school, or embarrass me and my brothers in front of everyone. Ronald, the eldest, was in Josh's grade 4 class. Kurt was my age, but in Jerry's grade, and Ethan was a year younger and in my class. He resembled Beaver Cleaver, but had the dastardly personality of Eddie Haskell. Rumor had it that Ronald and Kurt were so tough because they knew karate and had black belts. When Leroy and I tried ambushing Kurt and Ronald, they always outsmarted us, leaving us with bloody noses and black eyes. Even my brothers seemed powerless against the duo. You could never catch them off guard or alone. They were strong, tactical, and had backup with Ethan always close by. Going to school was like entering a battleground full of feral gangs, chanting and scheming and beating the shit out of one another. I hated every minute of it. Heart attack. "Where's your mom and dad?" Mandu asked. She was a pretty East Indian girl new to the school in my class. She sat in the desk in front of me, and when I got frustrated, I'd stare at the back of her head. The light played on her shiny black hair whenever she moved and reminded me of my mother's. I kept my eyes on the dragon I was drawing and thickened the lines until they turned ugly. I wanted to bawl whenever I thought of my parents. My dad hadn't come home from the hospital 2 years ago like Grandma said would happen over Christmas. All I knew was that he was sick and that he'd be home whenever he was better, but he didn't show up. Grandpa was furious and started spending a lot of time in the garage building and fixing stuff, drinking more brown pop than usual, and yelling at us. I got yelled at the worst, maybe because I looked like Dad the most. But Jerry got hit the most because he stood up to Grandpa. "Maybe he just stayed in the hospital," I reasoned. Grandma started to eat and sit in front of the TV, watching her soaps more. Sometimes the phone would ring in the middle of the night, and she'd run downstairs to see who it was. She'd whisper, "Sonny, is that you? Is that you? Please come home. We love you." She'd say this over and over until Grandpa came downstairs and yanked the receiver from her hand. Sometimes the phone would ring in the middle of the day, and I'd rush to answer it. I'd hear breathing but no words. Grim usually took the phone from me before I had a chance to ask who it was, but sometimes I was on long enough to ask if it was me who made him run away. The breaths would sometimes turn into what sounded like whimpers, but never words, and never a dial tone. Someone was listening. Grade 2 was tough on us. Josh failed it in 1981, Jerry failed it in 1982, and I failed it in 1983. I couldn't concentrate. I kept thinking about Dad. I didn't learn how to read, write, do math, or anything. Mrs. Z, my first grade 2 teacher, held me back. I hated that Leroy and all my other friends were a year ahead. I knew Mandu didn't know any of the stuff about my parents, or that I was a failure. My old classmates, on the other hand, did. For a while, I used to tell kids at school that my grandparents took care of us to give my mom and dad a break, that they'd come back to get us soon. I stopped when I realized that no one believed us, that our enemies loved watching us squirm. They said our parents had abandoned us because we were ugly Indians who ate from the dump. They'd ask us about our missing parents to be dicks and start fights. They chanted us with war whoops because Josh told them we once lived in a teepee in Saskatchewan. Idiot, I thought. The tip of my pencil buckled and a shard broke off, hitting Mandu's sundress. She brushed it away, and I knew she was waiting for an answer. "Go away, please," I said. "Didn't you hear me, Jesse?" she said patiently. "I asked, where are your mom and dad? I've seen you with your grandma on parent-teacher night, but never your parents. Why?" "If you really want to know, they're dead, and I'm an orphan," I muttered. But in my head, I was yelling, "I don't fucking know where they are." If Mandu were a boy, I would have hauled off and punched her in the mouth right in the middle of class. Mandu's lip quivered as she shifted backward. I pushed my dragon drawing off the desk and watched it float to the ground. Mandu leaned over. "I'm sorry, Jesse. I didn't know." She grabbed my hand and started crying. Her hand felt warm on top of mine, and I started crying too. She squeezed my hand. There was a nudge against my back. Then another, then another. "Look at the cry baby crying." A finger jabbed into my shoulder. I turned around and saw Ethan, Ronald and Kurt's sidekick. The freckles on his nose looked like someone shit on his face through a screen door. He was laughing, and so were some of his buddies. "Look at Jesse crying in class. Just like a baby, boo-hoo." Ethan pushed me and I fell forward into Mandu's chair. "What the hell is wrong with you?" she yelled. "He's a baby," Ethan teased. "Baby, baby, baby." I punched Ethan square in the eye. Spit flew out of my mouth, and my head felt like it was going to explode. I flipped the desk nearest to me into the air, knocking over a few chairs and hitting a couple people by the blackboard. "Who's the baby now?" I yelled. I could see Mrs. C leaping over about 5 desks to try to get to us. I grabbed my pencil and lunged at Ethan, aiming for his heart. Mrs. C tried to push me away, but I kicked and punched her. She had a tough time blocking my shots, and I think Ethan was afraid I'd murder her to get to him, 'cause he scuttled like a rat to the back of the room. I couldn't breathe. My chest heaved up and down. My heart was going 1,000 beats a minute. I started slamming my fists against my head. Mrs. C grabbed my arms and placed me in the hallway. Ethan and his cronies were making war whoops as she slammed the door behind us. Mandu was at the door trying to say something, but got lost in the ruckus. Mrs. C tried to restrain me. "What happened?" she asked. "Why are you fighting again? Why did you try to stab Ethan?" I could tell she was shocked. Hell, I was shocked. Ethan was lucky. I wanted to kill him. I would have gutted him if it weren't for Mrs. C. "Answer me." She put her hand under my chin and forced me to look at her. I squirmed under her gaze. I kept my mouth shut and furrowed my forehead right back at her. "Answer me. You could have really hurt him." I imagined Ethan dead on his back with a pencil jutting skyward out of his chest. I grinned at the thought. The more Mrs. C. pressed me, the more I dug in. If I was good at anything, it was keeping my mouth shut. I wasn't going to rat, not even on him. Not to her, not to the principal, and certainly not to my grandparents. Not a picture in sight. I loved Christmas. I hope I got the new Megatron, I said to Josh as I launched myself down two flights, landing near the base of the tree. Shimmering boxes, bows, and tinsel busted out across the living room floor. The lights flickered and danced, adding to the drama. After unwrapping my presents, I realized, to my dismay, that I'd gotten practical items like underwear, socks, or cruddy oversized long johns. It was, after all, Christmas with my grandparents, and they always bought us grandparent-like things. For breakfast, we had our traditional bologna, bacon, egg, hash brown, pancake, and bannock meal. I ate until I couldn't see. My stomach hurts, Jerry complained as he finished, adjusted his PJ bottoms, and belched. It's because you drank the corn syrup, Josh said. Should have left some for the rest of us. We all laughed because it was true. Even Grandpa was chuckling as he hummed to the Boney M song that blasted over the old record player. Grandma was at the counter. She was already three-quarters of the way through all her prep work, but she still had lots to go. I eyed the about 50 pounds of potatoes that needed peeling, a job she always saved for Aunt Sherry, and fired whatever leftovers I had under the table so Yorkie could partake in the gluttony. My hand was covered in slobber, but it was his way of saying thank you, and I loved the way his tongue tickled my fingers and the bing sound his tail made when it banged against the table leg. At noon, everyone began to arrive, first my Aunt Sherry and Uncle John, then my dad's brother, Uncle Ralph, and his wife, Uncle Ron, who was my dad's younger brother and best friend, and all my cousins, accumulating until we were packed in like sardines. The whole comedy roast started with my Aunt Sherry's cackle. The only thing worse than Ralph's turkey farts, she said, adjusting her apron, are Jesse's butter tart farts, so creamy. Can you believe a smell like that can come from such a scrawny kid? The living room quaked with laughter, and the pile of skinned potatoes next to my aunt almost fell over from the commotion. Each of us took a turn razzing the person next to us, and I swear my aunt turned beet red when Uncle Ron laid into her. As I sat on the couch and watched everyone bellow with laughter, I envisioned my dad at home with us, and it was like that the instant I opened my eyes that morning, hours before everyone came, before all the jokes. When I woke up, I'd picture him arriving at home looking like a gentle yet rugged Marlboro man in a black overcoat with rosy red cheeks and a long knitted scarf like Tom Baker's from Doctor Who. Grandma watched Doctor Who in between reading her Harlequin novels and watching her soaps. She'd been a fan since the early 60s, had seen all the doctors throughout the years, and thought Tom Baker was the best one of them all. I always figured Dad looked like him for some reason. Maybe I just wanted him to be as smart and brave as Tom Baker, as the doctor. I imagined Dad's grand entrance occurring at the perfect time, just as we were unwrapping our treasured gifts. He'd pause in the front alcove, scrape his boots on the doormat, brush gigantic Hollywood-style snowflakes off his broad shoulders, then look me right in the eye and smile, all without saying a word. I'd throw aside my gifts and rush into his open arms, the presence rendered worthless compared to the prospect of grabbing hold of our long-lost dad. Or I'd yell, "I'm mad at you," stopping short in front of him. "You left us with nothing, and all alone up in Sudbury." I'd kick his foot and try to stay mad, but he'd say, "I'll never leave again, Jesse." His cheeks still cold from the frost. "You have my word on it." Talking his way out of it, like usual, giving me all the sweet answers I longed to hear. I'd collapse into his arms and bury my face in his scarf, smell his cologne, and hold on for eternity. That was my Christmas wish, what I dreamt of that morning, and what I was dreaming of again. "Wake up, boy," Grandpa said. "You see this mountain of wrapping paper that needs tending?" Only his request for help taking out the trash managed to break me from my imaginings. I knew Grandma dreamed the same dream I did. I saw her look at the door even after everyone had arrived. I knew that every year, fueled by hope, she over-prepared. We watched in awe as she marshaled forth a parade of food, the same way she'd done every year since 1981. One of my cousins commented first, saying, "This is way too much food, Nana. How are we supposed to eat all this?" Grandma didn't answer, but kept the gravy boats and platters floating in. Plates, forks, food, and all my relatives mashed together, caught up in the force of it all. I understood what the flood of food really represented, but didn't have the courage to name it and stop its annual inundation. I sat at the dinner table watching my grandmother out of the corner of my eye. Between laughter and smiles, she discreetly and periodically scanned the front door, poised to spring up at the turn of the knob. I watched my grandfather, too, after dinner, as I played on the floor in front of the tree with my cousins. As usual, he sat glued to his armchair, swilling beer, until his speech slurred. I saw him staring at the police awards Uncle Ralph had won and that he'd display on the living room wall beside the fireplace. "See, Ralph," he said, pointing at them. The smell of beer now strong in the room. "That's my boy. That's a real thistle. And you," he fired over at me, "you're an asshole, just like your father. Oh, I know what you've been up to," he said, flicking the snout of his beer with his thumb and making it pop. "I'm watching you, buddy." I tried to understand what I'd done wrong, but couldn't. I stared up at the wall. It didn't have any pictures of Dad. None. In fact, there weren't any pictures of me or my brothers or my dad anywhere in the whole house. Grandpa kept glaring at me, and I ran to the washroom looking for a place to hide. He didn't stop as I ran past, but cracked a smile. I slammed the door. At the end of the day, Grandma collected the extra food and drink she'd laid out, embalmed it in cellophane, and then interned it in the freezer. I loomed over the unopened presents that lingered under our tree. They were addressed to Sunny Boy. They stayed under the tree, and the tree remained up for a long time, reminders that something horrible had happened and that Dad wasn't ever going to come home. We ate the leftovers well into February. The Fake Italian. Leroy kicked his leg over the blue bin behind the convenience store and disappeared inside. We dove in every other week and we'd find Playboy magazines, old gum, and maybe some candy bars. It was a good little after-school activity that kept us busy. People thought Leroy and I were brothers. We were together so much, except that I looked like some awkward mix of Italian and something else, and he looked whiter than a bleached bedsheet. Derek, the small Greek kid who lived across the street from my grandparents, was with us and was the darkest kid around, darker than Josh even. I thought I looked like Derek and his father a bit. "Score!" Leroy called out. He held a porno mag over the edge of the bin, and Derek and I cheered. "Anything else?" Derek asked. I heard what sounded like boxes shuffle and bags ripped, followed by Leroy saying, "We've hit the mother load." He tossed out a dusty box of Snickers and climbed out. "Check the expiry date," I said, as I searched the side and found a label, "March, 1984. "Must be from the back room or something," Derek said as he examined the label and ripped open the box. He had a bar unwrapped and in his mouth in a matter of seconds. As he tried to gnaw at the brown steel, the skin of the bar cracked and broke. "That shit's 3 years old," I said. "Don't break a tooth." Leroy stood transfixed near the edge of the bin. He was gawking at the skin mag. He flipped it around and showed us a picture of a naked woman lying down in the desert. She had on feathers and leather buckskins. Bits of her costume hung loose and revealed her breasts. "Your people," he said to me, laughing. I didn't know what to say, and picked up a Snickers bar and attempted to snap it in half to see if it was edible. It didn't flex a millimeter. I wasn't putting it in my mouth. Derek giggled and moved closer to get a better look. He said, "My brother told me about Indians." His mouth was full of chocolate as he looked over at me and tossed the wrapper on the ground. "Said they're all dead." Leroy held the magazine up and smiled. "She's not dead." The woman in the pictures was now completely naked, but was beside a painted horse and had a spear in her hand. "It's in that Iron Maiden song," Derek said, "Run to the Hills. My brother plays it all the time." "Yeah," Leroy added, "my sister too. I love that song." Both broke out into the lyrics. Derek holding his hands in heavy metal devil horns, Leroy headbanging his mullet. I could make out that the song was about killing Indians and selling them whiskey and destroying the buffalo. The only clear part was the chorus, same as the title. I assumed it meant that the Indians had to run away. I thought about when Derek's brother Moses played that song on the ghetto blaster in front of their house. I heard the name Cree in the lyrics, and Moses explained to me that it was about when the British Army killed a bunch of Indians on the plains out west and then gave the land to white people. "You're from out west," Moses said. "Are you Cree?" I didn't know what to say and wondered if my mom was a Cree for a second. "No," I blurted out. "We're Italian." The lie came from nowhere, but I thought it might keep me safe or include me somehow. "We have some Indian way back," I went on. "But my skin is dark because we have Italian in us, see?" I held my arm to his. "That's not what Josh said." He gave me a skeptical look. I thought about my parents and all the questions that burned within me growing up, and the resentment that had taken root. I hated them. I hated myself. I hated explaining to other kids where my parents were and why my skin was darker than theirs. I felt torn between wanting to be Indian and wanting to hide in my lie. Kind of how I felt standing there, listening to Derek and Leroy thrash to that song by the dumpster with the naked woman in the magazine dressed like an Indian. It would make life easier, I decided, to tell people I was Italian. Falling Apart, 1988 to 1996. My fabricated persona. "Life of the party," they said. Whatever they put in front of me, I did. Lines, joints, cups of straight whiskey, chased down by false manhood. I took bits of all the gods and mixed them together. Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Conan the Barbarian, Chavez the Native Horse Thief from Young Guns, and voila, an instant warrior. I drank more than they could, jumped higher, ran faster. But no one told me that Indians aren't made in Hollywood, and we were never meant to be the good guys. Oddball. I couldn't read for shit and stuttered, so I avoided reading out loud in front of everyone. I didn't understand how I graduated grade 5 without really knowing how to read and write, but there I was, at a new school, in amongst a whole new crop of kids. Leroy was in grade 7 and would walk to school with me every day, so I had the edge over some of the grade 6ers, who, I assumed, didn't know anyone. On our walks, we often picked up butts off the ground and pretended we were smoking. We didn't have a lighter or matches because John at the store had stopped selling anything cigarette-related to us kids after he found me supplying Mitch a few years back. Leroy's sister, Sylvia, however, smoked with her rocker friends, Mitch included. They all had big teased hair. Sylvia's hairsprayed bangs were a 3-inch wave cresting on her forehead. Her nose didn't stick out so much anymore, and she started getting bumps and curves all over. Her makeup seemed to sparkle the same dreamy way as the women in Grandma's soap operas, and my vision got blurry whenever I saw her sucking on a cigarette. And words? Forget about it. I couldn't form a coherent thought around her. The first time Leroy saw me acting like an ass around Sylvia, he said, "I'll rearrange your face if you look at her that way again." Still, I couldn't help dreaming about her and those cigarettes. Josh went to the same school and was in grade 8 with Sylvia, and Jerry was in grade 7 and had made a whole new batch of friends separate from Josh and me and our street crew. His buddies were now the smart and good kids from neighborhoods I didn't know. They didn't smoke or drink or cause any trouble that I knew of. They were awkward and read comics. But my brothers still held their ground. I felt safe with them and Leroy around. That left me free to explore, girls especially. One day in October, while waiting to catch a bus for our school field trip to the Royal Ontario Museum, I noticed her, up on the hill, in front of the arena right beside our school. She had flaming red hair and a pair of black and white British Knights running shoes. I knew her name was Lucy because I'd heard a teacher call it out at an assembly during orientation week. I'd heard classmates say that she was an excellent swimmer and took classes in the swimming club, where all the elite swimmers our age took lessons. She hung out with the cool kids, my friend Brian, and some rich kids. I wasn't like them, though. I walked around the bottom of the hill, fidgeting with my book bag. I wanted to talk to her, but my brain wasn't working properly, just like when I was around Sylvia. I could tell Lucy didn't even see me, sweating and rehearsing how to say hi. She was gossiping with two other pretty girls I also had weird feelings about. One of them was Kylie. She had long, flowy hair that made my guts do backflips. She had two sisters at the school that were into soccer, just like Kylie. They're a family of athlete goddesses, Leroy said. The other girl, a strawberry blonde named Sarah, was developed, as Leroy would say. It drove all us boys nuts. Everyone wanted to dance with her at the seasonal Much Music dances, and when the music started up, she was like a queen bee covered in a beard of adolescent males. I once tried dancing with her, but was almost trampled. I spent the rest of the night bopping in a corner all by myself, far from the hormones and chaos. "Hi," I managed to spit out as I got about halfway up the hill, 30 feet away from the three girls. They didn't hear me. "Hi," I said again, raising the volume a decibel or two. My voice cracked under the strain. I wanted to flee, but I pushed on. Still no answer. I thought they were ignoring me. But Sarah turned and rolled her eyes. "Look, it's that nerd that hangs out with Brian. What does he want?" Kylie laughed and looked me up and down. Lucy was silent and scrunched up her face at Sarah. "Hello. My name is Jesse." I extended my hand. "Is this where the class is supposed to meet to catch the bus for the school field trip?" They giggled. My hand just hung there. "Nice moves," I squirmed. "Real smooth." "Does this look like a bus stop?" Sarah retorted, pushing my hand away. Her flowered sundress looked menacing in the breeze. I had nothing left to say. No more moves, no courage. Kylie turned her back and whispered something to Lucy and pinched her nose as if I smelled. Lucy didn't react. I flashed her a smile. She smiled back a little, but I couldn't bear to be there any longer and went to leave. "Wait," Lucy said as she reached for my hand and shook it. "My name's Lucy. Nice to meet you." Kylie and Sarah were dumbfounded. Just like the rest of them. "Let's go to the mall," I said. Anything was better than lunch hour at school, even walking 2 kilometers, and there was a place called Frank's that served the best fries and gravy in the city. After, we could go to the convenience store and play Double Dragon or Time Lord on the arcade machines. Leroy was pretty good. I sucked ass. Richard was with us. He was a small German kid with a big head, who was just as mischievous as Leroy and me. He'd been in my grade 6 class the year before, and I'd done something with him I'd never done with Leroy. I'd skipped school. At the mall, Leroy pulled $5 out of his pocket. Richard had 20. I, on the other hand, pulled rabbit ears, like usual. When we got to the burger stand, the two of them slapped their bills on the counter, ordered Fly Baby, and laughed. Fly Baby is how Frank called orders of fries and gravy back to his wife, who manned the fry station behind the till. We kids had heard him say it a few times and started saying it ourselves. We thought it was funny. Frank usually gave us our orders without saying a word. Then, once we were far enough away, he'd turn to his wife and say something in Korean. Mrs. N, our home economics teacher, reacted the same way when I made fun of her Japanese accent during class, becoming silent. When I didn't do my assignments, which happened all the time, it was my way to shut her down. The class loved it every time I deliberately mispronounced something and encouraged me with laughter. For as long as I could remember, people had teased me about being a half-breed Indian, and I hated it. But when I acted the same way towards others, nobody ever focused on who I was. Mrs. N didn't deserve it. No wonder she failed me with the brief report card comment, frequently unprepared for class. After Frank handed over the two orders of fries, Richard inhaled his. He didn't share a single bite with me. I was insulted. After all, I was the one who'd asked him along, and I expected him to give me at least a couple of fries in return. Leroy, to my shock, did the exact same thing. He'd never done that before. To make matters worse, just before Leroy finished up, Richard reached over and grabbed a fry, all dripping with gravy, and chucked it in his mouth. He grinned at me, then turned to Leroy and said, "Those were delicious, eh, buddy?" Both cackled, mouths open, fry matter visible on their tongues. I was furious. I challenged Richard to a fight after school, in the park, across the street, where no teachers could interfere. He accepted. I stomped off, leaving the two of them chewing on their shitty fries. When the school bell rang that afternoon, I bolted to the park. Word had spread quickly that the crazy Indian was going to scalp some poor German bastard. A pack of kids followed us across the street and formed a giant circle around Richard and me. Chants of "go, go, go" filled the air as kids began shoving us closer and closer together. I swung first and hit Richard in the mouth. Stunned, he stood still for a second, then hurled his book bag at me, missing my head by about a foot. I followed with a straight leg to the gut. I was winning. Then he said, "Figures," coughing and holding his ribs. "You're just a dirty Indian like the rest of them." Everyone burst into laughter, followed by loud war whoops. The rage that fueled me drained away. Silence gripped my tongue. "You'll probably die drinking like they all do." The crowd shifted from my side to his, and I saw my street friends laughing and pointing at me. They believed it, too. They all believed it.